here on to the topic of this part of Focus 580. Metropolitan Chicago remains one of the most residentially segregated areas of the United States. But what about the rest of Illinois? What do we know about the state? Well, this morning in this part of Focus 580, that is the subject that we'll be taking up as we talk in this hour with Maria Creason. She is associate professor in the Department of Sociology at the University of Illinois Chicago. She's also affiliated with the Institute of Government and Public Affairs. And in her research, she is focused on racial residential segregation and also racial attitudes. She contributed a paper, an article on this subject to the Illinois Report for 2009, and this is something that's been put together now for a couple of years running by the Government of Institute of Government and Public Affairs here at the U of I. And it takes a look at a number of subjects, things like the economy and education and some health issues. That's available from the Institute if you'd like to take a look at it, or you can actually see it online if you go there to their website. And one of the things that you will see is the piece that our guest wrote. And also joining us, we have James Lowen. She's somebody who has become well known for thinking about, writing about, teaching about how it is we commemorate our history and how it is that we indeed teach history in school. He's authored a number of books and probably continues to be best known for his first, Lies My Teacher Told Me, sold more than 800,000 copies. He's also written a book on historical monuments. The title of that book is Lies Across America, What Our Historic Sites Get Wrong. That came out in 1999. Part of the reason that we're talking about talking with him this morning is that he's also written a book about what are called sundown towns. These are places where they actively discouraged African Americans from living. And we'll talk about what that is and how that has worked here in the state of Illinois. He's authored a book about that as well. And if you're interested in finding out more about him, you can go to his website. James Lowen is his name. His last name spelled L-O-E-W-E-N, and you can find out more about it. And of course, as we talk here this morning with our two guests, questions are welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is people just try to be brief so we can get as many as we can. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Well, Professor Creason, hello.
Hello.
And Mr. Lowen.
Hi.
Thanks very much to both of you for being here. We appreciate you joining us. Well, just at sort of the bottom line here, I guess, and we can talk about this in some detail, but I guess we should again reiterate the bottom line here, Professor Creason, is yes, not only do we know, and nobody's going to be surprised that yes, there is significant residential segregation in Chicago, in the city, in Metro Chicago, but so that's not really news. But we really don't talk about what's going on in the rest of the state, and it seems that the rest of the state of Illinois is not that different than Metro Chicago.
That's right. That's probably, we study Chicago a lot, and I studied Chicago a lot in my career, but it was very interesting to turn the spotlight to the rest of Illinois and to discover that when you look at the patterns, they really mirror what's going on in Chicago. In those communities where there is some racial diversity, there is also segregation.
Mm-hmm. Well, and this is something that, and if people want to look at this really closely in detail, I would certainly recommend that they look at your contribution to the Illinois Report, because there are a lot of numbers here.
Yes.
So not right for here on the radio to give people a lot of numbers.
Yeah,
right,
I won't
front.
Be reading any numbers.
What if you ask this question? Well, okay. What are we talking about? Are we talking about really, in terms of numbers, really high levels of segregation, or that it's there but is it's relatively small? I mean, is it possible actually to say something general like that?
Right. I think social scientists, I won't throw numbers around, but social scientists talk about something called the index of dissimilarity, which basically is a number that's calculated to describe the degree to which blacks and whites or blacks and Latinos live in different neighborhoods. And using that scale, they've identified numbers that they call high segregation, medium segregation, and low segregation. And just as an example, in the metropolitan communities that are outside the city of Chicago, 40% of those communities fall into the category of being highly segregated, and another 50% fall into moderate segregation. So that's 90% of non-Chicago metropolitan communities that social scientists would call highly segregated or moderately segregated.
Yeah. So you see this moderate to high segregation. You see it in the city of Chicago. You see it in cities outside of Chicago. But apparently, even if you look at more rural areas of the state, essentially the story is the same.
Right. There are very few. I mean, that's sort of where Professor Lowen's work can feed in. There's very few places that are non-metropolitan that have very significant numbers of African-American and Latino residents so that it makes sense to talk about segregation in those communities. But where there are, and there are about 12 such places where we can calculate black-white segregation, and about more than half of them would fall in the high segregation in the index.
Mm-hmm. And here the most significant kind of segregation is black-white segregation. You also take a look at white-Latino, which is, again, it sounds like it's that significant, maybe not quite to the levels of black-white segregation, but that is significant as well.
That's right. It's really the same pattern that you see in the Chicago metropolitan area that's throughout the state, and that is what some researchers have called the black exceptionalism, in the sense that black-white levels of segregation are much higher than Latino-white levels of segregation. And we see that in metro, non-metro, and outside Chicago metro areas.
Yeah.
If I might jump in.
Yes, please.
Yeah, it's interesting because, of course, African-Americans have been in the state for centuries and in considerable numbers since about 1863 when, during the Civil War, Illinois was a major staging ground for the Mississippi side of Civil War hostilities, and also therefore received all kinds of wounded and otherwise refugeed African Americans. And there was a policy, in fact, down in Cairo, which was the staging ground specifically, to distribute them around the state. They couldn't just pile up in Cairo. So black folks have been here in considerable numbers since at least 1863. Mexicans and Mexican Americans are much more recent immigrants. So you would expect, if there wasn't something going on called race, that black folks would be much more integrated residentially, and on this D, or index of dissimilarity that Maria mentioned, they would have a much lower index. Instead, they have a much higher index. So something is definitely going on with regard to African-Americans.
Yeah. And one other way to look at this, that indeed this article does, is you could ask this question, well, are there, say, look at the state, its demographic patterns, and ask this question, are there many places in this state where, in fact, there are very few, maybe even no black or Latino residents? And it turns out the answer to that question is yeah. In fact, we have a very significant number of Illinoisans who are living in places with really very little in the way of ethnic or racial diversity.
Yeah, that's what I, of course, studied. And I grew up in Illinois. I'm from Decatur and grew up listening sometimes to WILL. I want that on the record.
I appreciate that.
Yes. But I had no idea what was going on. And my book, Sundown Towns, is, of course, about towns that are all white on purpose. And Decatur, it turns out, is surrounded by these. So is Champaign-Urbana. So is all of the downstate Illinois, just about. There are, of course, towns that did allow African Americans, but a sundown town is a town that flatly does not allow black folks. They get this name because some of them, for instance, Casey, Illinois, not that's in your listening area to the southeast there. Casey had signs at the two main highway entrances to town that said, quote, "Nigger, don't let the sun go down on you in Casey," unquote. And those signs were up well after World War II, and they were obeyed. They may still be obeyed. I don't know. The signs are now down, and I'm not sure if Casey is a sundown town or not. Well, when I first learned about these, I decided I would write a book about them. I knew I was going to do a little more research in Illinois than any other single state. So I thought I would discover maybe 10 of these sundown towns in Illinois, maybe 50 across the country. But to my astonishment, I'm now at a count of 501 sundown towns in Illinois alone. This is 70% of all incorporated municipalities in the state. They range in size from tiny little D-land, which is just a little ways west of Champaign-Urbana, to big cities like Pekin, Illinois, 32,000, and, of course, even larger suburbs of Chicago.
Let me just very quickly, and I have a caller I want to get to, but I also want to very quickly, for anybody who's just tuned in, I want to reintroduce our guest. So this fellow you're hearing right now is James Lowen. He's a sociologist who has written a lot about how it is we think about, write about, talk about history. He's the author of a number of books, and maybe the one that continues to be most famous is his book, Lies My Teacher Told Me, Everything Your High School History Textbook Got Wrong. Another is Lies Across America, which is about historic monuments and how they get things wrong. And then this book that he just mentioned, Sundown Towns, A Hidden Dimension of American Racism. And you can find, I'm sure, any of these books in the bookstore in the library. Also joining us here by telephone is Maria Creason. She is associate professor in the Department of Sociology and in the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois Chicago, is interested in residential segregation in her work. And the reason that we're having both of them on is that she contributed an article on this subject, looking at segregation in the state of Illinois, to the Illinois Report 2009, something that's put out by the Institute of Government and Public Affairs. And she mentions here in her article some of the work that James Lowen has done. So she said, well, I'm going to be on the show. Let's ask him to be on the show, too. And we said that would be a great idea. So the two of them here, comments are welcome. And I do want to get a caller here. We have somebody who is on a cell phone. We'll get right here to them on our line number 4. Hello.
Oh, hi. Thank you.
Yes.
Well, if you added neighborhoods in Chicago, and you'd have even more sundown towns. There were whole neighborhoods in Chicago, South Shore, a predominant one, up until the late 60s. If you were black or you were white with long hair and you went to 71st Street, you are going to get physically hurt. Now South Shore is predominantly African-American. My question was, is did your study factor for class and socioeconomic class? Because there are some towns in Illinois where they're not that segregated, Cahokia, for instance, but everybody's lower middle class. So I wonder if you factored in
sure. The
economic class. I always like to say nobody would mind living next door to Michael Jordan. So.
Well, actually, some people have minded living next door to folks like Michael Jordan. And in previous years, some of the African Americans who broke or tried to break sundown ordinances or just sundown practices in some of the Chicago suburbs were indeed wealthy African Americans and often sports figures. But I think Maria probably has some good numbers on this, but I can tell you just right off the bat, the richest, and certainly the most prestigious suburb of Chicago is Kenilworth. And Kenilworth was founded in 1905 or 6 to be, among other things, to be free of blacks and free of Jews. And it pretty much has been ever since. I mean, those were official ordinances in its founding. So it isn't just money. And there have always been a few, not as many as you would expect in the population, but a few African-Americans who could afford to live in any suburb, in any community. But many of the suburbs of Chicago that have kept out African-Americans are working-class suburbs. So it's not just money. It isn't money. Money accounts for about one-seventh of the racial disparities that we see.
Hmm. Well, I appreciate the comment of the caller. I wanted to maybe Professor Creason would like to pick up on that, because I'm sure that that's it is something that you address in this contribution to the report that you wrote. And I expect that some people would say, well, yeah, that, you know, one of the things that's going to limit where you're going to live is can you afford whatever it is that people in that place are asking, you know,
right,
for the property.
Right. It's certainly conventional wisdom, and I think that, you know, and I appreciate the caller bringing this up, because I think people tend to think that it's all about money and money talk. So the reason blacks, whites, and Latinos live in different neighborhoods is because of the persistent economic and wealth inequality that we have in this country. And since housing is economically segregated also, then it's probably natural that we have racial residential segregation so long as we have these economic inequalities. But it's it's an intuitively appealing argument, but it doesn't really hold up when you look at the data. Virtually all the studies that look at this give a small role. I haven't heard 1/7, but I would believe Professor Lowen that only a modest part of segregation is caused by economic differences. So that if you take people who are at the same economic level and you compare them, they're just as segregated. As we say, poor blacks are just as segregated from poor whites as rich blacks are from rich whites. So, so it's a appealing account, but it's not doesn't bear out in the data.
Well, I'm just want to go back to Jim Lowen and just how in places with the, these places that were sundown towns, just how institutionalized or how formalized was the ban on having black residents?
That's a very good question, and the answer is it varied a lot. In some places, it's clearly there was a formal ordinance that was passed. It's harder than heck to find these ordinances, but they surely existed. For example, Arcola is another town that's right near Champaign-Urbana. And I had already, in doing my research, learned from several people that Arcola was definitely a sundown town. By the way, it allows Mexicans and Mexican-Americans, but it's not clear that it allowed African-Americans as of when I did my research there, which would have been about 2002 or 2003, and therefore I'm not sure if it does now. Maybe it does, I don't know. But I therefore, having already confirmed it, went to see the town clerk. Or the clerk at the town clerk. I think the town clerk is an elected position, and she wasn't there, but the town clerk's office had a clerk, of course. And I went to see her, and I said, hi, my name is Jim Lowen, blah, blah, blah. I grew up in Decatur, blah, blah, blah. I'm doing research on towns across America that kept out African Americans like this town. And the reason I said like this town is because I'd already confirmed it so many ways that I no longer was asking her that question. And she nodded, and I said, did Arcola ever have a law about this? And she nodded, and she said, you mean like our sundown ordinance? That's what I've heard it called. And I said, yes. And she said, oh, yes. And I said, well, can you show it to me? And she said, sure, but it's 4:20 or so. Can you come back tomorrow morning? So I was at the time actually a visiting professor, as I often am, at the U of I. And so I said, sure. And I came back the next morning, bright and early, and what do? We kind of went over to these boxes and old files and stuff, and we both pawed around ineffectually there for about 2 hours, and it became clear that she didn't know how to find this ordinance. I don't think that most towns do. They don't even know how to find their double parking ordinance. I'm not putting them down for this. I'm just saying this is how it is. So we never found it. But that's pretty strong, oral tradition. So that's the formal situation. The informally, I'll give you an example from this past January. I was in Calhoun County. Now, Calhoun County is a little ways north of St. Louis. It's in the southwestern part of the state. And Calhoun County, as far as I can determine, is a sundown town right now, today. It certainly has not a single black family that anybody can remember or know of, and it didn't have any in the 2000 census. There's allegedly one interracial couple, and they seem to be doing all right. They live in Hardin, the county seat, but otherwise, there's not a black person in the public school system, I don't think, and certainly none in the high school. So I asked a woman, and I need to say she's a resident and a person of goodwill. I said, do you think a black family could prudently move into Calhoun County today? And she said, no. She said, maybe if Obama works a couple of miracles in the next 2 or 3 years, maybe then. But now, no, I don't think so. And another person confirmed that indirectly. So how's that done? Well, if you have, let's say, 5% of the population, or even 2%, that thinks this is a sundown county, it's been that way for decades, it's supposed to be that way, and I am therefore doing the right thing if I beat the heck out of their kid when he or she goes to school, or I throw a rock through their picture window, or I burn a cross on their lawn, or whatever, well, then that does it, you know, because unfortunately, moving into a sundown town or county it's not like a typical civil rights demonstration in that you can't go home from it. You're there 24/7, and if the thug minority wants to keep you out, they can.
And I expect also they were with these places, if there were places that were known to have been sundown towns, had that reputation, that then, you know, perhaps things have changed, or perhaps it was a long time ago that it was formalized. But if they continue to have that reputation, then perhaps, people would say, if you were African-American, you would say, well, I'm just not going to, I'm not going to go there.
There's a reputation that's going on. And that's why I think every single sundown town in Illinois and every sundown county should take three steps. I call it a three-step recovery program. First, they need to admit it. We did this. And even though in some cases we have absolute proof with both written and oral sources and so on, it's hard as heck to get them even to do that. Then number two, we did it and we apologize. We're sorry. It was wrong. And number three, and we don't do it anymore. And that last one needs to have teeth. If you think we do, well, we've set up a human relations committee, or we've set up a racial ombudsperson, or whatever we've set up to say that we don't do it. And for that matter, just the act of saying those three things helps deter the problem, because then the thug minority and the realtors and anybody else who might be participating in steering African Americans away from the town or the county know that it's no longer informal community policy, and that they maybe want to think twice about it.
Hmm. Does Professor Kreisman, does the fact that this kind of discrimination we're talking about, the fact that it's illegal, does that do anything?
Does it do anything that it's illegal?
Yeah. I mean, you know, the fact that it's illegal that one can make a case. I mean, if you feel that you've been discriminated against in housing, now it's, I suppose we're talking about a different thing as if the community,
right,
in a sense, rises up against you and drives you out. But in terms of the opportunity to live various places, if one feels that you've been discriminated against purely on the basis of race, that is illegal.
It is illegal, and I think that's the puzzle that we have, because we haven't talked much about the causes of segregation, but certainly, as we just talked about, economics don't tend to be the predominant driving factor of segregation, but that there continues to be a role 40-some years after the 1968 Fair Housing Act declared discrimination to be illegal. There is still very strong evidence that discrimination continues to occur. There are some instances of very blatant segregation where people, you know, have doors slammed in their faces or are outrightly refused to be rented to or have a home sold to. But I think the patterns in the contemporary world are that it's more subtle. Discrimination is more subtle, and sometimes the victims of it aren't even aware that they've been discriminated against. So it's trickier to measure it, but there are studies that measure it that are called housing audit studies, where you send two people out posing as a renter or a buyer of a home or seeking a home to a real estate agent, and you match those two people on all of the other characteristics that would matter in the search for housing except for race, and you see if the African-American or the Latino home seeker is treated differently than the white home seeker. Those studies have been done. The most recent was in 2000, and it demonstrated that there is persistent discrimination against racial and ethnic minorities. It can be more subtle than in the past, but one example would be that steering, actually. So people being steered to communities where their own group predominates is one of the very frequent ways that discrimination is played out in the housing market today.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's talk with, we have some other callers here. Let's talk with someone in the community of Belgium, line number four. Hello.
Hello. I understand the premise of your discussion here, but I wanted to ask if you ever looked at it in a different sort of view. Are there communities around where people have essentially self-segregated themselves? Take the case of the Amish. Historically, the Mormons, where minority groups would put themselves purposely in a exclusive community.
Sure, there are, and the two cases you mentioned would be examples. And for that matter, there are a number of black communities in Illinois. I have to say, not a single one of them keeps out whites, or ever did keep out whites, and not a single one of them is therefore all black. And several of them are majority black communities, or even minority black communities, but are considered black communities by whites in nearby towns, because that was the only place they were allowed to live in an entire county or in an entire several county area. Down in southern Illinois, for instance, there's a town called Culp, C-O-L-P, and It's right near Herron, and it's right near Carterville. Herron and Carterville were both sundown towns. In fact, Carterville was such a severe sundown town that it did not even allow African Americans to be in it during the day in many decades. Herron did, and so some of the maids and janitors and other black workers that were allowed to work in Herron would get there from Culp. And people in Herron and Carterville actually thought that Culp, C-O-L-P, stood for colored people. The town is actually about 60% white, and it's named for Culp, who was a vice president, I think it was, of the Illinois Central Railroad. So that's not exactly free choice. But free choice plays a role, but it never rises to the level of it's a different thing. Let's put it this way. It's a different thing when it rises to the level of exclusion. And so that's what we find in these 501 sundown towns, that they are the choices by whites to exclude non-whites.
Thank you very much.
All right. And I don't know, Professor Creason, you want to add anything to that?
Sure.
Because certainly that some people, you know, when people are reaching for the explanations for the segregation that we have, I expect one of the things that people say is, well, you know, how much is it possible to say how much of that is actually voluntary?
Right. I think it's complicated. For example, you think of immigrants, recent immigrants to this country choose neighborhoods and communities where their language doesn't get in the way. They can speak their language and get by. I think what's interesting about immigrants, though, is over time, right, from generation to generation, they are becoming integrated into, and they are no longer tend to move away from those self-segregated, if you will. I think the challenge with any argument that talks about preferences is the degree to which these preferences are truly free and personal choices, unfettered by things like concerns about being discriminated against. So if we look at African Americans, that's the racial group that's often pointed to as saying, well, they're self-segregating, they could live in other places also. But if we look at measures of studies that have asked people what kind of neighborhoods they prefer to live in, African Americans really, for the most part, prefer, the majority of African Americans talk about wanting to live in a racially diverse community, not talking about wanting to live in an all-black community. So, sure, there are individuals who end up in all-black communities who want to be in all-black communities, but the survey evidence does not suggest that that's the predominant pattern. And then you have to ask, well, those who do want to live in predominantly African-American communities, for example, why do they hold that preference? Is that preference really neutral? Is it really because I want to be around my own group, or am I concerned about discrimination, having crosses burned on my front lawn, or just being singled out and not feeling comfortable because of racial hostilities?
We have two callers here I'll get to in just a moment. We're a little bit past our midpoint, and I would like to introduce again the guests for this hour of Focus 580. Maria Creason is associate professor in the Department of Sociology and the Institute of Government and Public Affairs. She's based at the U of I in Chicago, and in her research she is interested in racial residential segregation and racial attitudes. She contributed to the Illinois Report for 2009. This was something that's put together by the folks at the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the U of I. They've been doing it for a couple of years now, and it is a collection of articles looking at different aspects of Illinois, including the Illinois economy and other issues like education and childcare and health, and this is one of the sections. You can get a copy from them, or you can actually even read it online if you're interested. So you go to the website of IGPA, the Institute of Government and Public Affairs. And also joining us is James Lowen. He's someone who is also a sociologist by his academic training and has, over the years, spent a lot of time looking at history textbooks and historic monuments. His books include Lies My Teacher Told Me, Everything Your High School History Textbook Got Wrong, Lies Across America, What Our Historic Sites Got Wrong, and a book that really deals with much with the subject we're talking about here this morning. That's his book, Sundown Towns, A Hidden Dimension of American Racism. If you'd like to find out more about him, you can go to his website. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with some more callers. We'll go next to Urbana and line one. Hello.
Hello. I'm an Arcola native, and I think I may have spoken with James Lowen about the Arcola Sundown Law several years ago when he was on the program. I don't know if he has any interest in revisiting that The reason I know about it was the repeal of the law was precipitated by our high school getting a foreign exchange student from Africa. I graduated in 71, and so that must have happened in 1969 or 70. It was covered in the Arcola newspaper, which I believe may be archived through the University of Illinois libraries. But if you're interested in looking that up, the person who brought it to the attention of the town was the city clerk, Raymond Holterman, who also ran the Main Street Grocery. And he had been city clerk for many, many years, and he may have remembered the law because of his age. It could have been that he remembered the attempt to enforce the law back in the 20s and 30s. I don't know why he remembered, but we have a pretty good peg on when it was repealed, and it was covered by the local newspaper.
Well, thank you very much, and I will look. I will look for that the next time I'm in Central Illinois. And I got to say, also, you're calling from Havana.
Yes.
Because Havana, I think, is also, or was, a sundown town.
The caller was calling from Urbana.
Oh, Urbana.
not Havana.
Around here. Never mind.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. It's a very interesting discussion.
All right. Well, thank you. Let's go.
If I could add one more
yes.
thing. If anybody else who's listening knows of a sundown town, a town that was or still is all white on purpose, that kept out blacks formally or informally, maybe kept out somebody else, please tell me, and the easiest way is to email me at jlowen, so that's J-L-O-E-W-E-N, jlowen, J-L-O-E-W-E-N, at UVM, because I used to be at the University of Vermont, at uvm.edu, and I'd love to hear from you.
All right. And maybe I should mention, too, that the book I mentioned a couple of times here, Sundown Towns, this is not just about Illinois.
No.
This is about the phenomenon across the country.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Let's talk next with someone in Sadorus. This is line two. Hello.
Hi, greetings, everyone. This is an interesting conversation, and I apologize. I did come in a little bit late on the discussion. You may have already covered this, but I'm thinking racial problems are getting better overall. But I did want to point out and hope that the guests would acknowledge that there may be not such a high of a percentage rate, but the whites do get discriminated against. It's not just a one-way street. I can personally vouch for that as far as attempting to get rental properties in school when I was active duty military, in retail establishments, and having personally been run out of a neighborhood I lived in because my income was low enough that I couldn't afford anything else. And I just want them to accept the fact that does exist, and a lot of the laws we have today are against Caucasian males. And just acknowledge that fact, although that's not the primary problem, it does exist. And that's all I have to say, and I can listen to any comments they have off the air. But I do want to reinforce that this is definitely a touchy topic. I'm glad they're discussing it and not scared to discuss it. And it's a complicated problem. And I love everybody. So we'll talk to you later.
All right. Well, I thank you. Thank you for the call. I don't know, either you want to respond to what the caller said?
I do. I paused for a minute to see if Maria did. I am a white male, and I appreciate his call. I would like to hear from him if he'd like to email me about how he got run out of a neighborhood, because I think that's outrageous, and I don't put up with, or except when I have to because I'm outnumbered or something, but I don't put up with discrimination in any direction from anybody. I live in a majority black neighborhood in Washington, D.C., and I don't want to get run out. And regardless of the alleged sins of my alleged forebears, you know, I'm not into this kind of white guilt trip. On the other hand, as I think he indicated himself, there are no 501 communities in Illinois, even 501 neighborhoods, that made it impossible for white folks to spend the night. So it is primarily a white problem.
All right. Well, let's go to another caller here. Let's come back to Urbana and line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Check any town in Franklin and Williamson County in southern Illinois,
yep,
and you'll probably find that there were, and who knows, there might still be on the books, sundown laws.
You're absolutely right. If you can, if you ever find one and actually copy it or write it down for me, please send it to me.
That,
you're absolutely right. I think the only little community where black folks could live there besides Culp was a tiny little place called Freeman Spur.
That's exactly right. Yeah, yeah. There was a time when the Heron basketball team had one black kid, and that was a problem. And it was like, 1958. And he didn't stay in town overnight most of the time, although when he did, he stayed in the home of one of the other kids. Didn't live in town.
Yeah, nope, he lived outside town. That's very interesting.
Mm-hmm. Well, also I know that in Franklin County, as late as the 70s, houses were burned down because some of those little towns, a black person came into town even temporarily with somebody. And in the 70s, in the 80s, there was a cross burned in Franklin County on a lawn because somebody had come over from Carbondale to deliver some medical equipment, and one of the people was black that had delivered it. And so this isn't quite as old as it ought to be.
Nope. I would love to have you email me the details of those things. I may know about them, and I may not. And I'm always collecting more information. And incidentally, if you go to my website, which you can all find by typing Lies My Teacher Told Me into Google with quotation marks around it, my website comes up first. If you go there, you'll find a map of the United States, and you click on Illinois, and you'll see a whole bunch of hyperlinks that tell you what I know about the towns in Illinois, but it's not enough. And so then I'd love to learn more from you all.
Well, thank you.
All right. Thanks for
Bye-bye.
The call. Just for a second, you told earlier, the story about having been in Arcola and in the courthouse there and looking to see if you could actually find the ordinance.
Yeah, in City Hall. Yeah.
In City Hall. Have you found many other examples where, in fact, yes, it was on paper, it was down on paper, and there was a surviving copy, so you could say, it's not just a legend here.
No.
It's right here. Here's the piece of paper I can show you.
It's terribly difficult to find that. Mm. Unbelievably difficult. I have a photo in my book of the whistle on the water tower in Villa Grove because that whistle sounded at 6 p.m., and most of the residents of Villa Grove understood that to be or at least many of them. I haven't interviewed over half of them, but, you know, the majority opinion is that was for the purpose of telling African-Americans to be gone at 6 p.m. And since then, incidentally, Villa Grove is hardly alone. I found at least 9 other towns across America that sounded a whistle or a siren at 6 p.m., either to tell blacks to be gone or, in the case of 2 towns in Nevada, to tell American Indians to be gone. Well, you cannot put something like that on a municipal structure like the water tower and sound it at 6 p.m. for that purpose without an act by the city council. Can I find that in the minutes? Well, perhaps I could if I read them all from 1914 when the water tower went in through about 1940. But other than that, no, and I haven't done that. So it's very, very hard to come across it.
All right. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our two guests are James Lowen. He is a sociologist by training, has written some very interesting books about American history, how we think about it, how we document it. And this particular book that deals with the subject that he was just talking about is Sundown Towns, Hidden Dimension of American Racism. And also, we have as our guest Maria Creason. She is an associate professor in the Department of Sociology at University of Illinois Chicago. And the reason we have the two of them is that she contributed a piece on racial segregation in the state of Illinois to the Illinois Report 2009, put out by the Institute of Government and Public Affairs. And in her article, she mentions the work that Jim Lowen has done on this subject. And we asked her if she would be on the show, and she said yes. And she said, well, why don't you ask him to be on the show as well? So we're glad to have the two of them. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And on we'll go to Fulton, line 4. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Sure. I have 2 points, and first has to do with black communities, no black communities, because they all are open to whites living there. In the 60s, I was a student at Roosevelt University, and my best friend was black. And I lived with him on West Adams in an all-black community. I was the only white guy in the block and the only white guy in the community. And to say they wanted to run me out of town is simply isn't true, but they would constantly ask, James, what are you living with a white boy for? And it was clear, it appeared to me that the blacks were very the whites might look at the community and say it's run down. It's their community, and it's for black folks, and the white people can, you know, they don't need to be living there. And that was in the 60s in Chicago. And then when I was in police work in the mid-70s on the west side of Joliet, it was an all-black area. And we'd get some people coming in that were poor and of non-black race, and they'd want to move in that area because the rents were cheaper. And we pretty much had to tell them, you can't because they'll run you out. And there again, it was a run out. That was there was some gang activity there. But certainly it was an all-black area, and a white couldn't live there. And I just mention that because by far the emphasis is the other way. But I really don't think you can have an hour-long program and just present one side of the story, because it builds a kind of bigotry of its own. And even though it's heavily weighted to one side or another, I think you need to have at least a nod to the other side of the issue.
Sure.
Thanks for taking my call.
Okay. Well, I appreciate the call. Professor Creason, what do you think about what the caller had to say?
I think that, you know, he's right. I think being really, in any case, being the lone person from your racial group moving into a neighborhood is, you know, call it the pioneer, and we talk about it both ways. A white pioneer in a black neighborhood is what the caller was talking about, and African-American pioneers moving into white neighborhoods. And I think it's not a comfortable position, and it's for sure there's discomfort on both sides, I think.
More than discomfort, sometimes people do get in a sense, run out. I mean, you can stick it out, but there's a lot of personal cost involved.
Hmm. I guess I would think that given the, not to excuse it, I guess I would have to say, given the experiences that probably a lot of African-Americans would have and at particular times, particularly at the time that the caller is talking about, which would have been the time of rising black consciousness and black political involvement. And, you know, I guess that I suppose that it really wouldn't surprise me that such a thing would happen at that time.
Well, the good thing is on both sides that in the last 10 to 15 years, sundown towns have been, which of course the ones to keep out black folks, have been fighting a rearguard action, and many of them have stopped being sundown towns and at least allow a handful of African Americans to live there now. And some, it's more than a handful. I mean, Cicero and Berwyn, as Maria knows all too well, two nearby west side suburbs of Chicago, were sundown towns for many years. They had nasty race riots in almost every year, ending in one, 1951, 1961, I think 71 and 81, maybe even 1991, to keep out the next black family that tried to move in. But meanwhile, they didn't keep out Mexicans or Mexican-Americans, and both of them, particularly Cicero, became overwhelmingly Mexican-American. And now there's over 1,000 African-Americans living in Cicero, and maybe a similar number living in Berwyn. And so things aren't great there, but they clearly aren't sundown towns anymore. And I think the same thing is happening in a number of formerly black neighborhoods in Chicago, but I don't know. Maria, it's certainly happening in D.C. in black neighborhoods. Is that happening in Chicago, that you wind up with some whites in those neighborhoods?
I don't know. Some, I suppose. You know, there's always, I don't know.
Well, I certainly know the D level, the level of dissimilarity for Chicago, is slowly coming down.
Very minusculely.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. We have a couple minutes left. We have some other callers. We'll try to get in as many as we can. No, we'll go next to Urbana, and this is line 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Okay. You mentioned Havana, Illinois, a while ago.
I did.
And that's where I'm from.
Okay.
Originally, I can remember my dad telling me about the sundown law that blacks had to be out of town by 6 o'clock.
Yep.
I found out you were going to be on the program this morning, so I called over to the courthouse in Havana to see if I could find out anything about such a law being on books. And nobody at the courthouse knew one way or the other if it existed or not.
Yeah.
So I called the librarian, and once again, she didn't know if there was anything formal on the books or not. But what she did tell me, and I mean, I grew up there and I did not know about this, that there had been a black family that lived there and through the 30s, 40s, and they said that the daughters finally moved out in the 50s. Now, have you run across anything like this where there was the local family and it was okay for them to live there, but you didn't want any strangers?
Yes, that, I even have a chapter on that in my book called The Exception That Exemplifies the Rule.
Okay.
And in many cases, towns, for instance, Pena, Illinois, south of Decatur, drove out its black population around 1900. I think it was 1902.
Uh-huh.
Killed five people in the process. But they didn't drive out the barber. The barber was the barber for white folks, and nobody had anything against him. He had white friends and so on. So Pena proceeds to put the infamous sundown town signs at the north, south, east, and west gates to the city. And it becomes a nasty sundown town. It was even difficult for black folks to buy gas in Pena as late as the 1960s, maybe even into the 1970s. But meanwhile, if you look in the census for 1910, 1920, and so on, there's four, six, five black folks. That's the barber and his family.
Okay.
And so that's a common phenomenon, and sometimes these people are even known by the N-word. I mean, they're known in terrible ways, but they're kind of beloved at the same time that they exemplify the rule, and they kind of say, well, none of those other people will ever come in.
Right. Well, this family in Havana, I just found out, was the blacksmith and the milliner. So it's exactly what you're talking about. It was a trade that was needed. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Mm-hmm. We got at least one more caller here. This is someone in Champaign, and it's line one. Hello.
Yes, I'm going to squeeze in, I guess, at the middle.
Yeah.
I grew up in northwestern Indiana, which is called the region if you're from Indiana. Mm-hmm. And I was born in East Chicago, which is not part of Illinois. And at that time in the 50s and 60s, it was quite a mix of blacks and Mexicans and Puerto Ricans and a variety of immigrants from Eastern Europe. And so I grew up with my best friends being mostly blacks and Mexicans until we got close to 68. And things started getting sort of dangerous with Gary right next door and talks about riots. And my parents decided that the high school was no longer safe. We moved 15 minutes down Klein Avenue, and all of a sudden we were in an all-white town. I was only 12 years old, and that was Griffith, Indiana.
Okay.
And I was 12 years old at the time. I had to give up all my friends. I was not very happy about that. But the strange phenomena is because my parents didn't speak English and because we all had strange names, we became a minority in that town. And the idea of sundown, I never saw any people of color, not even drive through that town while I was living there in the 70s and late 60s.
Did you ever hear that it was that way on purpose?
It never even occurred to me.
No.
I knew that Gary was next door, and that people were leaving, you know, East Chicago and Gary and moving south. So consequently, you have Griffith and Maryville and other towns, which grew heavily and became all white.
In Northeast Indiana, Northwest Indiana.
Northwest Indiana, the region area, close to Chicago.
Furthermore, I haven't previously heard of Griffith, but it's, first of all, impossible. So
right.
Close to Gary that it could have been all white by accident, but I'm sure that we could find
right.
out.
Right, and all those towns run together, Griffith, Highland, Munster, and then you get close to Illinois, Lansing, Illinois.
Yeah. Lansing was a sundown. I've confirmed it.
Yes. Okay. So, just a little bit of tidbit.
Thanks
there.
For the information.
All right.
Okay.
Well, thank you for the call. We're at the point where we're going to have to stop. Real quick, Professor Creason, just, and I can give you about a minute. I guess the question we really haven't talked about is why residential segregation or discrimination in housing actually matters.
Right. I was just sitting here going, the thing we haven't touched on are the consequences of segregation.
Right.
You know, maybe it doesn't matter if we're all living in separate neighborhoods, but there's a whole other body of research that sort of calls residential segregation the structural linchpin of racial inequality in America. So because so much of what happens to you is influenced by where you live, right, where you go to school, the services you get, your access to transportation, to jobs, to medical services, all of that is linked so closely to where you live. Your opportunities are linked to where you live, so that if we're living in segregated communities, we're not there is that feeding into racial inequality. It's also feeding in the last caller, sort of exemplifies the lack of interracial contact, the ability to meet people on an equal status contact and get to know and have friendships. She talked about leaving all of her friends behind, all of her interracial social groups behind to be in an all-white community. I think that has impacts on racial attitudes and on intergroup relations and some of the trust and things that we have come up a few times during the course of this program.
Well, there we're going to have to stop because we're simply at the end of the time. Our guest, Maria Creason, she's an associate professor in the Department of Sociology, and she's also part of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs of the University of Illinois, and one of the contributors to the Illinois Report 2009, where she contributed an article dealing with this very subject. If you'd like to get a copy or look at it, go to the website of IGPA, and you can read it there if you like. And in her contribution, she mentions very significantly the work of our other guest, James Loewen, and he was joining us as well by telephone. And if you'd like to read any of his books, of course, go to the library, go to the bookstore, but particularly you might want to look at the book Sundown Towns, and or you can go to his website and find out more about him and his work. Professor Creason, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And James Loewen, thank you.
It's been fun.